Hey, everybody. Welcome to Roger and Me, a.k.a. Roger Ebert and Me, a movie review podcast tribute to Siskel and Ebert, in which two film critics, myself, Brett Arnold, and Mark Dusick of MarkReviewsMovies.com, we aim to cover every new theatrical release, every new streaming release that comes out every Friday, and we're going to review it in the format that Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert pioneered. It really is that simple. That's why the title is, of course, a riff on the iconic Michael Moore documentary, Roger and Me. It made a lot more sense when the movie was me rewatching Siskel and Ebert episodes and re-reviewing those movies from a modern lens and deciding whether Siskel and Ebert got it right. That was the initial pitch. And the weekly movie reviews was like an additional part of it. It was clearly became cumbersome, as you'll find out on this episode, where we're covering 11 new release movies that are out today, Friday, January 12th, 2024. So very quickly after starting the show, Mark, I had to make a decision whether we were going to continue doing the rewatching old movies thing or the thing I already try to do, but not as aggressively as I do now, which is watch all the new movies every Friday and be an authority and what I hope to be is a guide to people, specifically, you know, cinephiles, moviegoers, people who actually go to the theater every week, every couple weeks, every month, whatever it is. I know it, you know, you're making a valuable choice when you go out to the movies, and we hope to be the guide that helps you figure out what to see. And it's been a joy to do it. We've gotten a deluge. I don't know if that's the right word. I use fake words sometimes. That's another fun part of the show. We've got a lot of reviews lately on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So cool to see. We went from like 22 to 47 on Spotify, and we're at like 35 on American Apple Podcasts. I don't know the number on Great Britain, but we keep seeing more and more. So please keep the reviews coming. It really helps the show. We now surface when you search for movie reviews on Apple Podcasts. That is huge. 11 movies today, as I mentioned. I should let my co-host speak. Mark, hello.
Hello. I got not much to say except hello, everyone in Lithuania. We're apparently number one in Lithuania for... I don't know where that came from, but yeah. Okay.
Sometimes you have to wonder, was this a data glitch of some kind, or are we really... Like, people are driving around in Lithuania listening to us. People got bumper stickers, Roger, Ebert, and me. You know, we have a whole bunch of merch over there. You never know.
That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, who knows? We got to go to Lithuania. We're going to go on tour. We're going to tour the show. See where our fans are. I need a t-shirt or a bumper sticker that says as much, basically.
Huge in Lithuania.
Yes.
Yes.
My right. Other car is a Ferrari type of thing. 11 movies. I kept up with you, Mark. Mark kept logging movies, and I kept going, no problem, next. And then he kept logging more, and I was like, okay, I'll watch that one too, I guess. And I think this is one of the first times I've kept up with you. And it feels good. It also feels bad. Why did I do that? There are so many.
Because right now, we're looking at... Oh, boy. Yeah, we're looking at a good long recording session. Here we go.
Yeah, we are. We should get right into it. I will say the reason I did watch ones I may have otherwise skipped is that there's a lot of good stuff this week. It might be the second week of January, famously Hollywood dump month, where they put a lot of stuff they don't know what to do with. That's not, you know, no big bankable stars, no Oscar plays, just a lot of genre stuff, a lot of bottom of the barrel stuff, but also a lot of like festival fare and foreign films that don't get a wide release. They also sneak out in January, and there's many such cases this week of good stuff sneaking out. There's many such cases of high profile streaming debuts. We've got a Netflix this week, we've got an Amazon Prime this week, and we've got a Hulu this week, and Mean Girls the Musical is the main big studio release alongside Jason Statham in The Beekeeper. So we should get right into it with... It's not called Mean Girls the Musical. It's just called Mean Girls. I think they're really counting a lot on the stylization of the title to do a lot of the heavy lifting. There's a musical note in the A that is supposed to indicate to you that it's a musical, because the trailer doesn't really indicate to you that it's a musical. That's a whole other conversation about Hollywood and focus groups and how to market movies and deceptive marketing, etc. But the movie's here. It's called Mean Girls. It's a remake of the movie that came out. Is that 20 years now? 20 years ago?
Yep.
2004? Holy shit. Memorable screening, Mark, because 20 years ago, I was living in Skokie, Illinois, and this movie takes place in the suburbs of Chicago, and there's a part of the movie, and I was watching it at the Old Orchard Mall in a movie theater, and then at one point, Lindsay Lohan goes, "So we went to Old Orchard Mall," and it cuts to this indoor mall that is very much not the Old Orchard Mall, and the theater erupted, of course. Biggest unintended laugh in the movie. But the movie's great. Is this musical remake / modern reimagining, is it worth your time? Let's talk about it. Here's the trailer.
Oh, hell no!
Move.
Hey, PG-13, please. What was that?
Oh, Lord, it's the queen bee.
Regina George.
Don't look her in the eye!
You could be really hot if you change, like, everything. I met a guy in the
summer and I left him in the spring. Welcome to Health and Human Sexuality.
We'll be getting into abstinence, of course, then followed by in the spring, condoms and choking.
You're learning things now that I don't know how to teach.
Are you okay in there? We're concerned you're either doing drugs or having a toilet baby.
Ew.
My reaction, Mark, when I first saw the trailer, which again hides that it's a musical, and the movie does not hide the fact that it's a musical. Up front, it has a classic musical. This is a cautionary tale. Welcome to the musical. And the music only gets sweatier from there, I would say. One of the big ballads is Regina George singing a song that goes, "I am Regina George." And none of the music is inspiring, but the musical numbers are filmed in an exciting way. And I will say they are staged better than the other musicals we've talked about recently. And I would say both Wonka and Color Purple. I enjoyed the musical numbers in this more, even if the music is just as forgettable as it was in those other musicals. What I was trying to say is when I saw the trailer for this movie and it just looked like it was a weird reboot with the story we know, the characters we know, played by actors that are kind of no names, or I guess Broadway people maybe, besides Angourie Rice, who's the star, who you may remember from The Nice Guys as Ryan Gosling's daughter. Delightful performance. And she's been in many other things since. But the trailer looked like it was just a weird reboot where they're just saying the lines from the original with new people. And Mark, the movie never quite escapes the say the line from the original energy that the trailer gives off. And the musical stuff, as I said, better directed than a lot of other stuff I've seen recently. It justifies the movie's existence just enough, with just enough charm, that I still think the movie is like almost there. I'm glad I saw it, I guess. I don't know if I'll ever watch this one again. The issue is, it's awkward how often it's just repeating jokes from the movie. 20-year-old movie that is these lines are now iconic. They've been memed a million times. I didn't realize how many times I'd seen the movie until watching this one, where I recognized every time they repeated a line verbatim. And more notably, I noted every time they updated a line for the modern sensibilities. And it's almost always a "you couldn't say that today" politically correct upgrade, including the fact that John Hamm's character does not sleep with any students anymore. There's a lot of interesting things to talk about. I could talk about it all day, honestly. I'll let you jump in. Do you agree with what I'm saying so far?
Yeah, the musical numbers are, they're well shot, they're well staged, they have really good choreography, but they are so distracting because they are just telling you exactly what is going on in the movie, in the actual narrative, without any songs going on. They're not highlighting it. There's the big kicker to them. The thing that really killed the musical numbers for me is there's no humor in them. There's no jokes. It's not as fun. It's nowhere near.
No, she is
the material.
She is Regina George, and she is a massive deal, I believe is what she keeps saying.
Yeah, I am a massive deal. All of this other stuff, all the things that she's going. It doesn't work. The movie shows us that already. The story does that without the songs. The songs don't add anything. They don't highlight anything. They don't make jokes out of the material that's there that should be in there. And it's too bad because Tina Fey, again, wrote the screenplay for this one. She wrote the book for the
musical. she copy and pasted.
I know. She copied and pasted the original screenplay and the book for the musical and turned it into this. But I think there are probably some updates. I didn't see the stage musical. If the songs are like this, I don't really have any.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty bad musical. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It does. But there are
for
some
theater kids
here.
Only. Extreme. Because, yeah.
Here we go. This Mean Girls is 20 years old, as unlikely as that seems, but that's how time works. It is 20 years old. It came out in 2004 when the internet wasn't as big a deal. Yeah. Smartphones didn't exist in any form that people would have. All the stuff about the bullying and the backstabbing, that all happened face to face or behind somebody's back in this local school. And so you had this sense of that world being created. You can update that and include stuff as they do here with social media. There's a bunch of TikTok videos going around, Instagram, all that stuff is happening. And how does that affect this story? The story remains the same, but how does the updated time affect the story? That's what I wanted to see out of this. I kind of just wish it had been a straight up remake. Forget the music. As blasphemous as that sounds, I think you could do something with Mean Girls in the present day.
Oh, for sure.
And change it enough and change not just the jokes that were a little too mean, ironically, in 2004 for now, but change the whole entire structure of how clicks work these days with the internet and everything. And how does that unfold with this story and with these characters? That's the movie I wanted to see as I was watching this one. Because the songs are such a dead end. I hate to say it because the actors are good here and they put a lot into the songs. I think Renee Rapp, who plays Regina George, she's really good and she puts a lot into those songs and she sells them, but they're not, I'm not buying what they're selling.
I know.
That's
exactly.
The problem.
Exactly. And she is the clear star in terms of like, she did this role on Broadway and is now in the movie. And like, I think it shows that she like has experience with the role and really sells it. Even if you're right, the song she's singing, "My name is Regina George," over and over. And she's an apex predator. Like all the music is just like really like the worst, like what people who hate musicals probably think musicals are like. Like people are just talking and singing and instead of dialogue where it's supposed to be this expressive thing. And like there are parts, there's that one, the Halloween party song has some cool body choreography with all the people doing stuff. And I'm going to stay here that this is going to be a 2.5 out of 4 for me still, because like it's one of those cuspy 3 out of 5, 2.5 out of 4 situations for me where I almost want to recommend it because I did ultimately enjoy it. I found it grating that I'm watching a movie that is just watching lesser actors that I've never heard of repeat lines that I know. And eventually I came to enjoy these characters for who they were in this movie, even if they were repeating lines and stuff. So like there is some charm to it, but ultimately when you get down to it, if you've seen the original as many times as someone my age probably has, and you know the movie, it makes it more uncomfortable an experience. Like, I don't know if your screening was like, but I was at like a rowdy, like the press screening had a bunch of fans at it too. And like the new jokes were getting laughs. There's actually the biggest laugh in the movie is a Tina Fey thing that I won't ruin, but I'm delighted that she gets a big laugh. But I was in a room full of fans, clearly, and the moments where they're repeating the iconic lines that I think they want the crowd to like clap like seals at, everyone just sat slack-jawed at, because you can't, you know, you've seen a joke, you know the punchline, it doesn't hit the same. And when you do that over and over again, it really doesn't work. So I think this movie works when it's adding new stuff, even if it's, I agree, the musical stuff isn't the best thing about it. There are just some funny new jokes. I love Tim Meadows.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
Tim Meadows is always great and funny, and he's funny here, although the character isn't as big a deal in this one as he was in the original.
And the rewrite he got, the big line that I noted was in the original, it's "I didn't leave the South Side for this," and then he like breaks the fire alarm or whatever. In this one he says, "I didn't go to grad school for this," or something.
Yeah, I think they were trying to lessen the Chicago connection, which is very weird because Tina Fey is pretty well known for you know, the Second City stuff and all of that. So that's a weird dilution of a pretty good joke from the original. So,
and the Calteen bars in the original were for malnourished kids in Africa, and now they're for elderly people to gain weight. Like, it's just like very
Little tiny thing, and it's not that big a deal. I don't care, those don't matter. It's just that there's a wellspring of things that they could pull from with the changes in the world in 20 years, and they don't take advantage of that. And that's too bad, because the times that they do start to hint at this is what it would look like if Regina George became very popular on TikTok, and there's a national, it seems like a national outrage about the fact of what happened to her really with that school bus. Yeah. Oh, by the way, why did that? Yeah, you're right. The opening number with "this is a cautionary tale" and everything. Yeah. And like, you give away one of the most surprising jokes. This is clearly meant for an audience that already knows this material. So why are you doing the same thing over and over and over again? I don't get it. I'm more frustrated with it the more I talk about it. But it is too bad, because I did have fun with the cast and I liked what they brought to these characters. Yes. And the jokes that do work, they still work here. They're just lessened, because we already know the jokes.
And the reason I harp on the changes, Mark, is because for me, the movie just became an exercise in, okay, is it going to be verbatim, or are they going to change this one? I was just like, it became a game for me. And like, that's not what it should have been. And like, I don't want to blame the movie for that, but you kind of do, for the reasons we're talking about, where it's a movie made for the fans that doesn't change enough. So the fans are just kind of getting warmed over what they've already seen. The biggest change that drew like a gasp from me, because it wasn't funny anymore, was the thing that I've said to friends over the years is like a running joke. You know, she tries to get out of going to Madison with her mother to see a play or something. And in the original, it's, "but you love Ladysmith Black Mambazo," and that's the concert they're going to. And in this, it's, "but you love Neil deGrasse Tyson." Like, it's just not funny. Like, I don't know. So those are really minor gripes that are stupid. I liked that the musical numbers, they went widescreen for everyone to differentiate. But it also, I liked the roaming camera, but it all felt a little like a movie that was supposed to debut on Paramount Plus streaming. It makes it feel a little more like that televisual to me, the kind of stuff it's doing. But man, I thought it was cool, even if I was kind of laughing at the songs. There are some really good new jokes, like the new Damien, what he's singing at the talent show really made me laugh when it's revealed.
Yeah,
like, I heard someone in the crowd clearly get the joke before they reveal what it was, and that made the anticipation of it so much funnier when they revealed what he was singing. So shout out to the person who figured that out, because it wasn't in English, and that was impressive. Anyway, 2.5 stars, but like an affectionate 2.5 that isn't necessarily telling you not to go see it. I just think it's like a one and done. I saw the musical version. It's not an improvement on the original. It made me want to watch the original. It made me appreciate the original for launching like Rachel McAdams and Amanda Seyfried. Yeah, like, so also surprised by the lack of certain cameos and the inclusion of certain ones too.
I pointed out that the Walmart commercial had more cameos than the musical remake. That was weird.
You know why? That's a byproduct of this was going to be a streaming movie, I feel like. Like, if it were always considered a theatrical thing, they would have absolutely spent the money, I guess, was the problem. Like,
spent the money, or the actors would have been more interested instead of just looking like, oh, they're throwing us on Paramount Plus.
Yeah.
So we're not going to go.
There's something fresh to it with that modern update that we're talking about with the TikTok stuff that justified it just enough, and the music justified it just enough, even if the music is not good and the movie often plays like karaoke, not in a musical way, but in a we're saying dialogue from the original, this is just a cover song way. And it really calls attention to itself sometimes with those like callbacks. like he doesn't go here gets like a reprise. So yeah, clearly I know too much about this movie. I didn't realize. It was a cult classic.
It is a cult classic. That's the entire reason that we're getting a music, why we got the stage musical, and why we're getting this.
And it's going to open big too. I'm like fully prepared for this to open to 30 plus, and I think it will. And yeah, I was realizing.
And I hope it's because people know it's a musical, because I'm getting sick and tired of them advertising things as not musicals and when they are musicals.
That's a conundrum now, right? Because like, if it does well, are they going to say it's because they marketed it not as a musical? Like, it's just so they set themselves up for, I don't know what they're going to think, if they're ever going to even make these again, because they're going to take all the wrong things away from box office now.
They always do that. They always take the wrong thing away.
Yes. But I hope they take the right thing away from this next movie, because I want a franchise. Let's talk about The Beekeeper, the unexpected. I'm going to go ahead and say it, Mark. Best movie of the year so far. 2024, to be clear. We're 11 days in. I've got one. Here's the trailer.
To Easter Clay. This place was crabgrass and weeds, and you brought it back to life.
Mrs. Parker and I were friends. She was like family. She was the only person who ever took care of me.
I just got a message saying that there's a problem with my computer.
Yes, ma'am, we got this.
Yesterday, she shot herself.
This is private property.
Do you know what they do here? Scamming the weakest in our society.
Buddy, I'm count to three.
One, two, three. There, I did it for you.
This movie is such a softball, and it like lobbed right down the middle. Could have easily been a swing and the miss, but this movie understands the silliness of the title being The Beekeeper, the fact that it stars Jason Statham, the fact that it's an action movie, and you're going to be like, what do the bees have to do with any of this? It's all baked into the movie. I feel like it knows how silly the premise is. And more importantly, the like targets, the bad guys in this movie, that's like the ingenious part for me, is that they wrote a movie about like the bottom of the barrel, worst possible criminals that you'd have no problem seeing dispatched by Jason Statham. And they make you really feel for the characters. It's a movie about people who fish scam, if you know what that means, basically do telemarketing style, get an older person on the phone, tell them they're from the bank or whatever, get them to give them their passwords or access to their computer, and then fucking drain all of their money. This is a real thing that happens all the time. It's happened to my parents, not to the same degree, but like it happens to people of a certain age. It's a very real phenomenon. And this movie basically said, what if there was a John Wick revenge style movie where a guy just went around avenging like people who were wronged by fish scammers? And you're like, fuck yeah, that's great. And it's Jason Statham. And by the way, he's a beekeeper. And when he kills people, he usually will dispatch a pun about bees. There's a to be or not to be in this movie. But more importantly than the puns, there's like the pontificating about the nature of bees and like the hive mentality and the you gotta take out the queen and like all the bee bullshit they graft onto the movie. It's just, I think I said about The Painter last week, Mark, that this movie had that movie had flashes of inspired silliness and it didn't run with it. It didn't know how to engage with it. This is a movie that has that inspired silliness and absolutely knows what it's doing. And just when you think it can't get any sillier, it has like a brilliant, it goes all the way to the top style reveal. I had a blast with this movie and I was not expecting it. The critic, I don't know who it was, the guy behind me, we started laughing early and often, I will say, and we had a blast.
I started laughing early and often. That reveal that I saw coming a mile away, I cackled when they actually went through with everything.
Yes.
Like, it has to be that. It has to be this. It has to go that far. And they went for it. They know, you are absolutely right. They know how silly this is. They know exactly what the audience wants, which is Jason Statham walking around and talking like a badass, even though he is somehow dressed in like a hooded jacket and an oversized baseball cap. I think it's actually a trucker's hat. He's dressed that way for most of the movie. And he's still a badass because he's Jason Statham. And it's hilarious the fact that he is that way the entire movie. And no one seems to realize, like, you're not supposed to mess with this guy. Don't. When he says he's going to kick your ass, he means it. When he says he's going to burn down the building, he means it. And nobody believes him. It's like, that's part of the joke, is that Statham is just playing it that way the entire time. And so it's extra funny to watch all of these slimy people. And there are some really slimy people in this movie. And the actors playing them, oh, they chew it up so much. Josh Hutcherson is really funny as this, like, privileged CEO of this company. There's a, I need to find his name. There's a South African actor.
Oh, Taylor James.
He's the heavy for the big climax that plays out like a hitman level.
Yep.
And he is hilarious. Just this guy who's walking around certain he can kill a beekeeper. Oh, yeah. We didn't even talk about the plot, really, except for, so he's part of a secret government, an extra governmental agency. It's like beyond the FBI.
Do we need to talk about the plot? I feel like there's a movie like this that comes to straight to video usually every month. And I just think it's funny.
I know.
No, you're right.
But he's part of this group and he's just there to keep society moving. That's about it. And so he's working outside the law and working towards justice and all that. And Statham just, I mean, he's probably the best action star we have right now. I can't think of someone who does this better.
I love Jerry Butler. I love a Gerard Butler. But I think Statham is maybe more consistent, or just has more. There's just more.
There's more going on there. It's just a lot of fun. I don't know what else to say about it. It's a lot of fun. The action is shot really well. David Ayer directed it. It's like the bare minimum that you expect a movie, an action movie, to show you how all of the action is functioning at any moment. But he does it. And I'm going to give the bare minimum credit here, because this could have looked as trashy as the screenplay is, but the fact that it acknowledges the fact that it's trashy and silly, and it gives you exactly what you want, and it shows you all of the things that you want, I can't not recommend it. It's a solid action movie with the sense of humor about itself, but not mocking itself in a way. It's just acknowledging this is supposed to be fun and silly, and you were getting exactly what you want out of it. And I got exactly what I wanted out of it.
Totally agree. And I think it's very post John Wick in the big gag being when you mention the word beekeeper to like any criminal, they go like, oh no, like the guy, like they all know him as like this horrible figure that's a huge running gag in the first John Wick, right? Like everyone being told like, oh, this is the guy you fucked with? Like, oh my God, you're dead. And like, that's the same type of gag that's going out through this movie about how badass this guy is. And when they reveal that the beekeeper actually is the secret society, and like, you know, what are some other lines in this movie? If a beekeeper says you're gonna die, you're gonna die. There's just so much stupid bullshit in it. And you know, what I wrote down for that John Wick quality that I'm now describing, I feel like I have to call it something. I'm gonna call it classic one guy did this. movie where it's just like one guy can take on a million and he's, you know, without breaking a sweat. You know exactly what this movie is going to be. As I said, we talk about a movie of this caliber. What's the deal? I feel like they used to be called like The Driver or something, right? Like, and it makes sense because, like, you know, the guy's a driver for the heist or whatever. Or like, I don't know. At some point, they started becoming like the accountant and the locksmith and the bricklayer and the baker and the beekeeper. And it's just so funny that they all are the same thing. It's like, yeah, the thing they're talking about is a cover or is a secret code name that means something. And this is the best version of that post John Wick revenge action movie that I've seen. And I've seen a lot of them. It just delivered everything I wanted from it, especially the like just vague enough political litmus test stuff where it's like, is this movie supposed to be talking about Trump, or is it about Biden's family, or is it about Obama? It really is about like they pepper in all those references, so it's just a grab bag of political nonsense, and it's just, you know, it's dopey bozo cinema, I think, as my buddy Jesse calls it. And it's peak, it's exactly what you want from a B movie. It knows it's a B movie.
I'm sorry, what? The B movie with Jerry Seinfeld.
Fuck. I didn't even think about that. How did I not think about that? It's a B movie with Jerry Seinfeld. It's a B movie in the sense that it's a programmer that would play second at the drive-thru. You know, it's a movie, and you're right about it, like, not being ashamed of itself. Like, it knows what it is, and it commits to it, and it's as silly as it is, like, crazy, over the top, delivering in the action that you want sort of way. The plot is batshit crazy, goes all the way to the top. Loved it. I had a great time. I can't recommend it enough. It's like the strongest possible three you can get in January.
Yeah, it is a solid 3-star schlocky entertainment that is going to play gangbusters on cable. Streaming. We're not in 2004 anymore, as we learned from Mean Girls. It's 2024. When this hits some streaming platform, people are going to watch the hell out of it.
This will be in the Netflix top 10 for at least a couple weeks. Yeah. That's the new TNT afternoon viewing, I guess. All right. Now this one's a bummer. We'll get it out of the way. Here is The Book of Clarence, a movie I really wanted to get behind. It's such an ambitious swing, and it just doesn't work. But here's the trailer.
I'm Clarence.
Where I'm from, you fight to survive. I'm not a bad person. Just playing the cards I was dealt. Mom, one day I'm going to get you out of here. I have a plan.
What are we doing here?
Jesus lives there. Hallelujah, baby.
I want to be like that in 10 years.
I want to be like that now.
I need to figure out what inspires him.
I can just replicate what he does. Imagine money people will give us.
Hallelujah. Holy shit, I get high as Buddha. Put you on that highway to heaven like I'm your Uber.
Oh, dead one, open your eyes.
Elijah.
I love Lakeith Stanfield. I thought this guy's previous movie, The Harder They Fall, it's like a Western, a neo-Western, I guess, on Netflix. I thought that was fun and visually interesting. The Book of Clarence is an absolute mess. And when you consider it's 2+ hours, it is just unwieldy and a chore to sit through. And I'll let Mark walk you through what it's about, because I don't know how I would just be able to describe it.
It's kind of hard to describe, because the hook in that trailer where he tries to become a second Messiah as Jesus of Nazareth is walking around doing all the preaching and miracles and all that. It's a good hook. And it doesn't show up until about like halfway through the movie, because it is a very confused narrative. It doesn't exactly know what it wants to do until it hits that point. Up until then, it seems more like a parody of biblical epics and sword and sandal epics that we got like back in the 60s and 70s and before that, because it has all the signs of it, even like the big proscenium introduction, like book one, all this, you know, you can tell exactly what it's parodying. And then at a certain point, it stops becoming a parody even, and it doesn't work because it has spent so long mocking the entire genre that it's trying to fit in, and mocking kind of lightly the idea of religion and religious fervor specifically, and how everyone is attached to it. And then it becomes a very sincere movie about faith and what it means to believe in something and why you should believe in something. And it doesn't work, because you can't spend like more than half of a movie kind of joking about all this stuff and then say, yeah, you know what though, we didn't really mean all those jokes. It's not that bad. We don't really think that stuff. What really is important is what you believe and how you present yourself in the world and how you act on those beliefs. And it's like, wait, I don't need a treatise on faith and all this. You gave me a comedy.
Yeah.
And you stopped being a comedy.
Yeah. It is absolutely confounding, that tonal shift from silly to deeply serious melodrama, like the most possible serious melodrama you could be, just like brutal, like Passion of the Christ style religious stuff going on. It's very confusing. But Mark, what even is the satire? Like, the jokes are so one note. Like, what if there were black people at this time and they were like racially profiled? And what if there was a guy who sold weed? And like, the humor is I was trying to pinpoint what the jokes were. And I just was like, I think there was that point where he has a baptism and he gets slapped, and that was supposed to be funny. I just could not pinpoint what the satire was or what the jokes were, what the target was. It's just so silly one minute, so serious the next. I thought the opening for a second, when it's just doing Ben-Hur chariot races to start the movie, like what if a Ben-Hur chariot race was like, I don't even know what they're trying to get at. Like they're racing in the town. And did you have that little intro from the director before the movie that played?
No, I did not.
Oh, when we saw it at Sony, they played this like 5-minute clip from Samuel James talking about the movie. And he talked about, he just loved biblical epics like Ben-Hur and stuff like that. And I just, even him talking about it, it seemed like he had no idea what this was supposed to be. There's some great music in it, and it's all like anachronistic, and that's the point. There's this Knights of Egypt scene that I enjoyed, but like all of it just feels like the parts that work are like a music video, and the movie has no narrative through line really until it decides it wants one at the very end. I found it to be like a really, really painful sit.
It's hard to sit through because it shows so much promise in flashes early on. And I, as soon as it did find that narrative hook of him trying to make money by replicating what Jesus of Nazareth does, that was funny. I was genuinely involved in laughing at that stuff. But man, it just, I don't know what it's, I also don't know what it's trying to do. I know it is copying that style, the biblical epic thing. It makes sense that Samuel would say, I really appreciate those because it looks great. It does look really good, but it doesn't have much to say until the very end. And by the time it gets to that ending and everything it has to say about it, I think it contradicts everything else that it had been doing in terms of the humor and in terms of the parody. And it just doesn't function. It doesn't blend those ideas together because they're contradictory ideas. You can't give us Life of Brian, but at the end, instead of always look on the bright side of life, it's like he has a revelation about, yeah, you know what? Maybe we should take all this stuff seriously. You can't do that. It doesn't work.
How awkward was that? Such a disappointment. That the Last Supper sequence. Like, what the fuck was that?
I laughed at some of that. It's the joke is good. Yeah. Look, the joke is good. The joke at the heart of it is good, that Judas is trying to like deny everything that he's been doing. That's a good joke. But it's done in a musical form and it kind of ruins the joke. I liked Alfred Woodard as Mary, Jesus's mother. I really liked that scene. Yeah. Especially her delivery, like I was just minding my own virgin business.
Yeah.
I really like that stuff. Yes. It's a good scene. It's really funny.
Yeah, it would have been a nice sketch, not a two-hour movie. Yeah,
this is doing that sort of Monty Python style of story where it is kind of sketches, like the weed scene where they're all floating around, the hookah bar scene. They're floating around in the air because they're high. And
that
like,
was
okay,
inspired. I like that.
It's some funny stuff.
Yeah,
but I don't even think it works as a random sketch comedy about religious stories and biblical epics. It doesn't quite function on that level either because the jokes are hit and miss, and I think they miss more than they hit. But it's mostly just the whole contradictory nature of the thing. It doesn't work. It's such a disappointment because I really like The Harder They Fall. That's a really strong film. I think that was his debut, at least feature wise and then to come to this where it has so much promise and it doesn't fulfill it in any way, it's such a disappointment.
Yeah, you feel every second of this movie. And I will say there's a character, it's Jesus. Jesus looks like the like dumpster bum from David Lynch's Mulholland Drive in this movie. That's all I could think.
Well,
I felt like Samuel James must really like that movie because it on him right away.
Well,
exactly like that.
Yeah, it's not exactly Jesus. Just to point.
Well,
that
yeah.
Out.
To be well, yeah, yeah. I know.
Yeah, to be clear, there's a bunch of stuff going on with that at the ending, which is kind of.
I was doing shorthand.
Yeah, yeah. There's a subversive track. That's the weird thing too. There's a subversive track going on about like religion and the view of Jesus from his historicity to reality as we see him now. It's like that's a really good idea, but it comes in at like right at the end while it's also taking itself seriously.
Yeah. All the story elements are so rushed and don't work. The necessity of belief bullshit. And
It's more than disappointing. It's frustrating because you can see all the stuff that it's trying to do and it can't quite do it. And when it does kind of take those big swings, it fails so often.
Yeah, it's a 1.5 star movie for me, unfortunately.
Me too.
Ugh. Big bummer. Wanted to like it. It's not good. And next up, we have what feels to me, Mark, like Kevin Hart went to Netflix and said, I want to be Vin Diesel in the Fast and the Furious. Give me my own movie. And they went through their script drawer, or they plugged it into their algorithm, and we got Lyft, which looks on its face to be more like a movie like Plane. And I guess it kind of, well, it's only an it's not really like Plane, but I feel like the marketing makes it look like it is. It's more like a Fast and Furious movie where instead of a bunch of cool, exciting set pieces, there's just one, and they really build up to it the whole time. Here's the trailer.
Agent Gladwell.
Am I in trouble?
You and your friends are looking at identity fraud, money laundering, and transportation of stolen property. But I'm here to offer you a deal. We need you to steal something.
Okay, guys, listen up.
All right, I don't have time to watch that whole trailer. You guys get it. He's a Kevin Hart plays a criminal who at the beginning of the movie has just pulled off the very first ever NFT heist, a very timely
topical.
Very timely if it came out a couple years ago or whatever. Really labored now to be like, remember NFTs? Well, we stole one and it costs, it's valuable. Anyway, fine enough setup. He's a criminal and the police need, I don't fucking remember. The police need to hire him to do a heist for them, and then they'll, you know, their criminal records will be wiped clean. It's a Fast and Furious situation. I believe this happens in Too Fast, Too Furious, and then is the whole basis for the rest of the franchise. Is there like extrajudicial crew of murderers and heist doers? Anyway. Kevin Hart is the lead of this one. So they go and gather a crew, and the whole thing is they're trying to like make a plane invisible so they could get under another plane and take gold off of it, I believe is what they're trying to do. None of that matters. And ultimately nothing here really matters. I really
very like... existential on this one.
I really like Gugu Mbatha-Raw. Most people, her breakout was that movie with Gina Prince-Bythewood, Beyond the Lights. I thought she was amazing in that. And she's since been in a million things, including the debut after the Super Bowl Cloverfield Netflix movie, The Cloverfield Paradox. I like her a lot. And she doesn't really have a lot to do. She's just like the CIA or FBI or whatever it is, lady who has to reluctantly put up with him and of course become his love interest. Vincent D'Onofrio doesn't get enough to do. I like Billy Magnussen, but everyone feels like they're just doing nothing. It's such a nothing movie. And they actually did shoot in all these foreign locations like Venice and stuff, but the movie still ends up being entirely green screen and useless anyway. It did little for me. What do you have to say about it?
Did very little for me too, and it is a heist movie that just puts the team's already there, so the team is just there doing their thing. We never really get to know them except for a couple, like D'Onofrio is playing the master of disguise, and it almost feels like after the fact they decided to say maybe he's not that good at his job because all the disguises are terrible, and I don't know if that's a makeup and costume thing or if that was D'Onofrio's idea or something, but it doesn't work, and he doesn't have much to do. Neither does the rest of the team. There's a pilot who just sits in a flight simulator thing for most of the movie and then is flying around. There's no character there. There's no personality there. There are characters I forgot about when I was like writing the review the next day. Like there's an engineer, the guy who puts all the things together.
I don't remember it.
I know.
It was an 11 movie week, Mark. I don't remember any goddamn thing about this.
This is my curse, is that I can't remember just enough to be annoyed when I forget. Wait, there's more team members here, and suddenly realize, oh, there's an engineer. That's right. And he sits out most of the movie.
Well, it's a MacGuffin, right? Like, are there?
I know. There's all the twists and everything. Blah blah blah.
Yeah. The all that stuff is horseshit too. Just like lazy writing. Yeah.
It it undercuts everything that it could do, starting with the fact that it puts Kevin Hart in the starring role and it makes him boring and bland and not funny at all.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Kevin Hart's a funny guy, and he seems to have said, I want to be a serious action star. And I don't even think he has any action scenes in this. He must fight a couple guys or something. Yeah. I don't remember them.
Stripper pole.
Oh, sure. Yes, I do remember that now. It just feels like a thankless role for him, and like he wanted to do a Fast and Furious thing, because it really just feels like such a ripoff of that. Right down to the ending of the exact same ending as one of the movies, which I may or may not have already mentioned. It's just funny how this movie is like all building up to this plane thing, and then they do it, and it's just like CGI garbage that doesn't look like anything. I just couldn't believe. I'm like, okay, if they're building up to this thing and it's a Fast and Furious ripoff, they have to have spent some money on like one action scene. But no, it all looks like garbage, and there's just nothing to recommend. It's a 1.5-star movie as well.
Yeah. The big heist, they spend the first part of the movie preparing for it, getting all the timing right, making sure all these pieces have to be in place. And then the heist happens, and it doesn't seem as if any of that practice was worthwhile. Because but there are two planes on this radar and nobody really cares about it. And the precise timing, I didn't understand why she had to get the jet underneath the plane at the exact time. They don't explain that, but it's like this big buildup with a countdown timer and everything. Like, why do you need to do that? I don't understand any of that.
I had no idea what they were doing. I just know that they were doing it. Like, the movie kept making clear, like, we're going to go under that plane, and if I do it exactly right, they won't see me on the radar. And I'm like, cool. Why are you doing, what's that for? Like,
it's elaborate. Yeah, because it seems as if they're trying to get the money, the gold onto the plane, and then they come up with this other idea to mirror the GPS tracking signal and send the plane. And then it turns out, no, that's not what they're doing. There's a drone. I'm like, I guess that was a new addition. It's so confounding, and it doesn't need to be confounding. It's just, and it feels that way because you don't have any attachment to the characters. None of them have any kind of personality. There's no bickering and bantering that really lands. And stop trying to make Lyft the thing. That's, we're not robbers. We lift things from things. Stop trying to make Lyft the thing. So it's not going to become a thing. It's so forced.
It's one of the most confusing posters I've ever seen, because the movie's called Lyft because it's about people who steal things. But the word Lyft is plastered on a plane, making it sound like it's like a movie about that, like a mode of transportation, like a lift. A lift is also an elevator. So it just doesn't, it's just a nonsense. Nonsense movie. Physics,
you need lift, get the plane in the air.
Right. Who knows? Exactly. Whatever. Exactly. But you're definitely right. It implies something that's not there by putting the word lift on a plane. Like, no one thought about that. F. Gary Gray directed this, which is sad to see sad to see any real director make a crappy Netflix movie. If you don't know who he is Friday his first, or was it Set It Off before that? Set It Off was after Friday, actually.
Set It Off was after Friday.
Friday, Set It Off, The Negotiator. Yeah.
He's done some good stuff.
And he's also did Be Cool, one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah,
the sequel
to
Get
Shorty. More that territory.
This is more Be Cool than Law Abiding Citizen, which I liked and I will defend. Did you like that movie?
No, I did not. But come I didn't on. Hate it. Did I hate it? I don't remember. I'm giving this one 1.5 stars too. That's where I'm at. We're done with this one.
Fine. I won't
about F. Gary Gray's filmography.
I will not talk about how Law Abiding Citizen is, if you work like a menial job at like a movie theater, or like if you're a mover, someone you work with, it's their favorite movie. I can guarantee you that.
I've seen that.
It's a phenomenon. It's a real life thing. It's real. It's real. All right. I agree. It is a 1.5-star movie. And this next one, will you be hearing those words again? Perhaps. Maybe. This is a movie that I didn't know about until I was sitting down watching it. It's called Role Play. It's on Amazon Prime today, I would gather. And it stars Kaley Cuoco, or as I call her, 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. And David Oyelowo. Is that how you pronounce that guy's name?
Oyelowo?
Yeah, that guy who I've always enjoyed and stuff.
Yep.
Here's a trailer.
How was Nebraska?
It was
The usual.
Mr. Brackett, can you tell us what happened that night at the hotel?
It was our anniversary, so we wanted to go out.
I won't be me, you won't be you.
Just two strangers meeting in a bar.
Tomorrow night.
I'm Jack.
Alice.
Do you and your wife role play often?
What exactly is this about?
Do you know this man?
No.
Jack Bob Bob Jack.
Pleasure. He just talked for 5 minutes to all the victims of her charms, and then he left.
This movie made me laugh right away, Mark, because it just boldly declares up top that Kaley Cuoco is of the most sought after assassin on Earth. No one else can do jobs but her. And they make evidence of this by just telling you that. And I'm supposed to believe it. And I go, okay, right on. This movie, I think the setup is actually kind of fun. It just doesn't do anything. It's one of those things, Mark, where any like low rent action movie, which like all these action comedy things are, I just can't get excited about the action in a world where we have John Wick level choreography and lighting and amazing choreography, whatever you want to call it. In a world where that exists, I can't get excited about the action and stuff like this. So, okay. So it has to be funny enough to justify watching. And it just isn't at all funny to me. It's another, what was that movie? The Wahlberg one, Family Plan.
Yeah,
same deal where it's like one of them's pretending to hide their past or whatever. She's an assassin and her kids don't know. That's the crux of this movie. Her husband and kids don't know that she's an assassin. They think she's off doing like, you know, boring conferences for work and she's out doing murders. And that's supposed to be funny. And the fact that they don't know is played for laughs. And then, but the movie pivots. And tell me about the pivot.
Which pivot?
Well, the whole premise of the movie is not what you'd expect.
I don't want to give I don't want to give away the specifics.
Oh, sure.
I think I like this more than you did.
Okay.
I'm not going to recommend it, but I think that it because it doesn't focus on the action, which seems to be your complaint about what it doesn't do right. And I agree, it doesn't do right when the third act does become about action. But what it does is it has more to do with people talking and people trying to hide things and people. The entire set piece of this, the centerpiece of this, is a conversation at a hotel bar with a character played by Bill Nighy. And the fact that it's Bill Nighy elevates it immediately.
Yeah,
it elevates the material. It elevates the scene. And that scene really works because it's Cuoco and Nighy at a bar talking and kind of there's something going on there. We all know what it is, but it doesn't matter because in the moment you can see the two just kind of playing this battle of wits and this mind game going on. And then Yellow O's character comes into the picture and they're playing their own game because the couple's on a role playing expedition in New York to try to spice up their love life. And it's a fun scene because it's just about these three people talking and trying to get what they want and trying to hide who they are and all of that stuff. I like the fact that the big set piece of this movie is just people talking. I like that. I appreciate the fact that it's trying to make that effort. I also appreciate the fact that the Oyelowo character has to actually deal with the fact that his wife is potentially a professional assassin. And he wrestles with that. And it gives some credence to the idea that these are real people dealing with a situation that is very formulaic. And it is a very formulaic situation, but I think it does just enough differently with it to a point that I enjoyed it and I had fun with the characters and I had fun with the performances to a point. I'm going to keep saying that to a point. I had fun with it. The shortcomings, I don't think Cuoco is convincing as a professional assassin. There's just something about her that doesn't, I don't know. It's the same thing with Kevin Hart. Like, yes, you're trying to push the boundaries of your screen persona and everything, but you know what? Maybe you do what you do well because you do it well. And it's okay to stick with that for a bit until you can play the badass. And I don't think she quite is there yet to play
character. You're right about the talking part because they have good chemistry then.
Yes, like, they do.
Yeah, yes.
All that stuff is a lot of fun.
But, you know, just watch True Lies. That's my review.
Okay, well, there you go. But the shortcoming is when it gets into the action. And, you know, this doesn't this doesn't work as an action movie. It's not supposed to work as an action movie, I think, because I think it is trying to do something a little bit different from this very familiar premise now of the hidden life, the family trying to, you know, finding out about it, and then all the adventures they go on. It's doing something a little bit different with it, and I think it works, again, to a point, and then it just stops working, and that's unfortunate, because the stuff that's strong, I think, works here, but it doesn't in the end, ultimately. Anyway.
It's just such a shrug, who cares
it is.
Type of movie for me, that it left no real impression. But it's not actually a 1.5 for me. It's like a 2, because I agree there's some I think the role play scenario setup and like where the plot goes is clever and fun, even if the movie doesn't do enough with it. So like I'm like halfway there. I think Kaley Cuoco's good, even though, you know, when as an assassin, I don't know, as a character, she's good with her husband or whatever. It's a forgettable movie that I've already mostly forgotten.
The stuff that sticks out is the Nighy material. He gets two really big scenes that work very differently, but work both times. And then where the plot does go, to have Oyelowo's character have to deal with everything that he's learning and figure out, do I love my wife or do I have this moral code that I need to uphold? That stuff was fun for me, but
it gets so self-serious. And
yeah,
I would argue the emotional stuff it tries to pull off does not really work. Yeah.
The third act doesn't work. It just simply is it trying
to do too much? I also found it really flimsy, just like in the setup. Like there's a part where they're like, you know, I'm not going to try to spoil it, but you know, she's like, well, we'll worry about it later. Like, I'm going to go and we'll talk about it when I get back type of thing. And like, it's just so flimsy in its setup, because I'm like, your sister knows. And like, she would tell. And like, it just seemed like very far-fetched the way people were reacting to things.
I know what it is, because there's a police investigation. I think that's the best way to say it. There's a police investigation and they're trying to decide what to do about that. And I wish it had followed through on that instead of coming up with the usual plot with her backstory and how she fits into it. And that's the reason that she can't participate. What if you actually did have a professional assassin who knows exactly what happened, try to participate in a police investigation and get around it? Like it's sort of talented Mr. Ripley thing. That could have been a fun idea, but instead it skips all of that stuff to get to the globe trotting and the big action climax. Whatever. That's when it becomes way too generic for me. I'm giving it 2.5, but that's mostly because of the performances and how well it pulls off what it's trying to do up until that third act. And I'm disappointed it doesn't carry through on some of its best ideas, but well, whatever.
I thought you were getting choked up there for a second.
Oh, like, no.
It's okay. Sorry. It's okay.
It's okay.
There are like five more movies. Some of them will be good.
That's why I'm getting choked up, because I'm realizing we're like halfway through this episode.
And it's been an hour already. Yeah. Brutal. Let's keep it moving then. The next movie is Self-Reliance. It is on Hulu now. It played in theaters for one night only, I think last week on like the 3rd or something. Here's the trailer. It's written and directed by Jake Johnson and stars Jake Johnson. If you don't know that name, you probably don't watch a lot of television, or specifically New Girl and Minx and whatnot. I'm rambling. Here's the trailer.
Hi.
Are you the actor Andy Samberg?
I am.
I'm a big fan, man.
Thank you very much. Hey, I got a question for you. You want to get in? Thomas Walcott, single, no children, no dependents. Job is network management, physically fit. Guess they're not too strict about that one. I'm joking. Kind of serious, though.
You have been selected to partake in the biggest reality show in the dark web. There will be people trying to kill you, the hunters.
What are you talking about? There's people trying to murder me?
Oh, shit!
Very much so.
You will have 30 days to survive. You will only be killed when you are alone.
So let me get this straight. You cannot touch me if I'm with someone, and then I get $1 million.
What are you doing, man? Why'd you leave my side?
I had to take a shit.
Why didn't you wake me up and bring me with you?
Because I'm taking a shit.
Okay. I think I like this more than you did. I would argue that the premise is fun, but I'm going to use my favorite word here and call it a little sweaty as well, because it's not just, you know, hey, you're on a dark web reality show. There's a bunch of people trying to kill you. If you survive for 30 days, you win $1 million. The movie's not truly about that. It's about the loophole he claims to have found in the rules, which state that he must be alone when he is killed. If he can stay in the company of others for every second for 30 days, he'll survive. How hard can that be? So then the movie becomes really a story about a guy who is afraid to break out of his comfort zone, of his stale routine, and is kind of a loner. And this movie to me is about how, like, you shouldn't let life pass you by, Mark. You should go out, meet people, and live your life to the fullest rather than cocooning yourself in a depressed state. And that's like a relatable thought to me as someone who I have a lot of FOMO about people having, you know, having a good time without me at the bar. But realistically, I'm not going out to the bar. I'm very happy at home and I don't want to leave. But there is a restorative power to spending time with other people. Every time I end up out and have a great night, I'm like, why don't I do that more? People are great. And this movie to me is really just about that. And it took this high concept, silly premise to get to that very human truth underneath it. And, you know, sweaty to get there. Like, it has to make this premise, and it has to do the, like, is he crazy or isn't he thing, where, like, is this really happening or isn't it? So, you know, if I were to really sit down and nitpick, I think there's a lot you could say about it that doesn't work, but it's just a comedy mostly. And I found it made me laugh a lot. There's a lot of good jokes. There's a good Super Mario joke. There's a good the Michael Jackson jacket joke I really liked. It's got Biff Whiff in it. If you're a I Think You Should Leave fan, you'll know what I'm talking about. It really coasts on Jake Johnson's charm and humor. So if you don't care for him, I don't think you will. Great Ellen DeGeneres joke. Yeah, I don't know. I had fun with it. You had less fun with it?
Had less fun with it, Brett. And it's because of everything that you said, of all that other stuff that it's doing. It is that big question. How hard can it be not to be alone? That's kind of the driving force of the plot, and also all this, like, metaphorical stuff that's going on behind the scenes, which is that Johnson's character went through a really bad breakup and he doesn't know why and he can't get his life back in order after that. And you have Anna Kendrick come in and they have this whirlwind sort of romance because she's participating in the game too, and all the stuff that happens there. And he kind of latches onto her as sort of a rebound after many, many years. It's a weird thing, whatever. It all feels as if it is trying to get at this more parable allegory thing than it is just embracing this very funny premise of a dark web reality show where people try to kill you. And how do you get around that? And how boring it would be to be on such a show once you figure out exactly how to get around it. Because it is, there's not much going on with the show. He's like, they attempt to kill him like maybe three times over the course of the entire movie. But that's fine because it lets all the jokes come in and it lets it be absurd and silly of him trying to stay close to somebody. That stuff works and it's funny. And Johnson is good here. But his screenplay is doing so much. It's trying to do so much. And I don't think it pulls it off at all, especially by the end. And all of that stuff with, is he crazy? Is he imagining all this? Is he delusional? Or is it actually happening? I didn't buy any of that, because that just adds an entire other level of what's going on with the narrative. Is he actually imagining all this stuff, or is it actually happening? I didn't buy it. I didn't buy that stuff. I didn't buy the relationship stuff that much, because it's nothing new. His character is just boring and dull and can't get over a breakup. That's that simple. And it's
your take is, get over it, shithead.
My take is, give us something, give us anything else with a character who is, like, you know, in his 30s and stuck in a rut. Like, could it be anything else other than a bad breakup?
Did you like the joke about what his prize actually was? The money.
You mean the money?
Kind of. Is that funny to you? Is the Wayne Brady joke funny? I was trying to get what, if anything made you laugh.
No, I did laugh. I'm not saying I didn't laugh. I think it works as a comedy. It works as the sort of satire of those thrillers like The Game or There's tons of them. I can't think of them off the top of my head. The Game is the big one where it's, you know, you're participating in a thing and it seems really high stakes and all that. But it says it's just dull and boring because he's just going through his normal life, but hanging out with people more often.
Yeah.
And that's kind of amusing. And there are some good jokes. And your Biff Whiff is, I'm a big, you know,
Tim Robinson.
Oh, no. Yeah, Tim Robinson fan. I really like that. I can't, it's too complicated of a title now. I can't remember. But yeah, Santa Claus himself is in this. That's all. So I like him. He's funny. It works as a comedy, and I don't think it pulls off all of the bigger existential questions it's going. I mean, it has an Emerson essay. It rips from an Emerson essay to get its title. It's going for something bigger here, and it doesn't pull it off. That's where I'm at with it.
Right on. I would argue it is, I'm going to say it a 15th time, sweaty. It's sweaty. But
stop,
I think
trying to make sweaty.
We're going to make sweaty the word of the year in 2024. We're getting Roger and me sweaty. We're going to sell sweatbands. That's the only merch we have, actually. Just sweaty sweatbands.
Huge in Lithuania.
Huge, very sweaty
if
people.
If you skip the intro, you have no clue what any of that means. Go back.
Yeah, I think it works because it, you know, I agree it is trying to take on a lot and the script is messy. But, you know, I just kind of was picking up what he was putting down and appreciated that he was trying to say all these things that, you know, it's definitely like a first time filmmaker giving him a pass 3 versus a 2.5 that it probably really deserves. But I'll go ahead and give it the 3. I recommend it. I think it's worth the watch if you like Jake Johnson, for sure. And if you don't know if you like Jake Johnson, you will have an opinion after, probably. So check it out. It's on Hulu now. You said you were 2.5? No, 2?
No, I'm 2. I'm 2 stars on this. Two. I like Jake Johnson. Again, parody, as a parody satire, kind of works and then just gets way over its own head and doesn't pull it off.
Right on. Let's talk about a Shudder original, Destroy All Neighbors.
How's that band going?
It's mainly me these days. I just want to finish my album.
You have been trying to finish this album for 3 years.
1, 2, 3! What is this?
It's a progressive form of prog. I've been calling it prog squared.
The only way I listen to your music
is if you tie me up at gunpoint and you forced me to.
And don't play it here again or you're fired.
Going on?
I think we have a new neighbor.
I feel like I should like this movie on paper, but it ultimately doesn't amount to much, even if I think the score is really great. I like all the music in it. I'm a huge prog person. I hope I am nowhere near as annoying as Jonah Ray is in this movie as a prog person. I think the music is done by a longtime Earwolf podcast producer and musician Brett Morris, and he used his real name on this, which threw me off. Ryan Kattner is actually Honus Honus from the band Man Man, a band I've been seeing live for like 15, maybe even 20 years now, a band I love. So like, I'm happy for them that they made a score for a movie, and that I thought the score was great and the music was all the best parts about it. But in terms of like, this is supposed to be a horror comedy, I guess, that's basically very practical effects heavy, and it just doesn't really work for me. And it's got Alex Winter in a bunch of makeup giving a performance that I think is supposed to be funny that I just didn't understand what the joke of the character was. Why did he look
like
the
Eastern European accent? That's the joke. Come on.
The joke is he has the Eastern European accent and they gave him a bunch of facial makeup, which you'd expect to come into play a little more than it does, I guess. I kept waiting for like a supernatural transformation or something because of how goofy he looked. And yes, the movie has plenty of practical effects stunts with that character. It just never quite justifies what it's doing or explains what it's doing. Again, I think I should like this movie. I like Jonah Ray. I like the people that made it. I like the score. But it's just kind of a forgettable Shudder movie that doesn't it feel like it's just vamping to get to the end? Like, it doesn't really have a story. It's like, what if you had a neighbor that sucked and then this happened and then as a result, this happened. I just couldn't really get a grip on what it was trying to be.
It's trying, I think, to be sort of a comedy of errors with this like very unlikely guy becoming a serial manslaughterer, as he calls himself. And
right.
That's a funny joke. But
not a funny
also,
movie. Yeah.
No, it's not. It's not a funny movie. And then it also has this whole thing of trying to be a lot more than it can be, where it is about his mental state and whether or not he maybe could be an actual killer because of how frustrated he is with his career and with his album not going anywhere and with his relationship with his girlfriend and that failing and falling apart and all of that stuff going on. And it's once again trying to do too much with a very simple premise and not pulling it off. And I'm it's so frustrating because Jonah Ray Rodriguez, I like him too. I think he's really funny. I think this might be, he's done a good number of movies, but he hasn't had like a leading role, I think, until now, other than Mr. Science Theater 3000, which I think is a cursed entity in terms of trying to do your own movies.
Well, you can't be a guy. Well, I guess that this is damning myself to never making a movie, which is fine. I don't expect to, but like you can't be, especially in comedy, like a person that isn't like Mystery Science Theater 3000 makes fun of movies. So when you are in that and then you try to make a movie, the bar is just so high already. Like if it's bad, it's just embarrassing, right? It's like you're making fun of it and you're no better than it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what I said. I think it's cursed because Bill Corbett, who was on the show in the first run, wrote Meet Dave. Kind of famously now, he makes fun of the fact that he wrote Meet Dave because it's a bad movie and he spent his entire career making fun of bad movies. Anyway, the point is, I like him and he's good here, but the movie is doing all these things with either actual resurrection or some sort of mental breakdown, and it never makes it clear which it is.
Yeah.
The practical effects are so cheap that I'm pretty confident that's the joke, and it's fine if it's the joke.
That's
the
like,
only joke.
Yeah. That's like Shudder's aesthetic at this point is so it is. Cheap. It you're wondering if it's part of the point that it's cheap. And it's like, no, they just don't have much money. But
they don't have much money,
charming.
And they use that as an excuse to make a joke about it. But I think there is a somewhat funny idea about this guy who seems like the most cowardly, impotent person who can be, who ends up killing a bunch of people, either intentionally or
like,
by accident.
And haven't you seen Tucker and Dale versus Evil? I just feel like it ends up being like a ripoff of that. If it's just like, I mean, that was more very directly like a parody of horror tropes and stuff.
Correct. Yeah.
But it's still the same idea of like, what if these hapless dudes were killing people? I don't know. It's similar, not the same.
It's sort of the same idea.
I think you're right. The biggest problem for me was the world building not being clear about like what's happening in reality and what maybe isn't and how things are transpiring. But you know, there's some inspired practical effects, like the moment where the guy is a ceiling fan for no reason. I'm like, that looks cool. What's going on there? But it's a really empty, like, not the best Shudder original I've seen. It's like the part of Bo is Afraid where he's afraid of his neighbors, but like, what if he took action? There's also like gay sex uses a punchline in this movie, I feel like, that's just very old fashioned and not funny. And I don't know. The joke gets old fast, really, even though I enjoy seeing.
Well, once you see what the pattern is doing, once you see the pattern is doing, it just becomes very easy to figure out, oh, that's going to be the next joke. And yeah,
it was disappointing. Sorry to Jonah Ray and who I used to see all the time at the weekly comedy show he ran with Kumail Nanjiani, The Meltdown. Good for him. Happy he's in movies. Think he's a cool guy. This character was not great. I didn't like this movie very much. 1.5 stars.
Yeah, 1.5 stars for me too.
All right, let's keep it rolling. Let's talk about Tim. T-I-M.
Wouldn't it be nice not to have to lift a finger ever again? Because everything is taken care of. The dream is now a reality. Welcome to the ultimate personal assistant in your home. We guarantee he will change your life forever.
Hello, I'm Tim, your technologically integrated manservant. How can I be of service?
I think we're going to be really happy here. I love you.
For when the fully integrated technology falls apart?
Trust me, Abby, you know exactly where you are with a robot.
I hope to bring you a life of ease and pleasure. If you'd kindly give me a safe phrase, I will be fully operational.
Safe phrase?
A series of four words that will trigger an immediate shutdown. To ensure peace of mind.
I'm not sure about this.
We said things were going to be different here.
Georgina Campbell from Barbarian. It was nice to see her. I knew I recognized her from somewhere. This movie is exactly the movie you expect it to be, I think. It is an AI warning movie. It is a robot, evil robot movie. It is like an evil smart house movie. It feels very post-Megan, which was already doing stuff other movies had done in the past. Explain what Tim is.
Tim is a technologically integrated manservant who falls in love with his owner and
yes, he does.
Becomes a passively aggressive, technologically integrated manservant. This is such a silly movie.
It's so silly.
It is so silly. It is so funny. And unlike The Beekeeper that we talked about, which I think knows how silly it is, this movie has no idea how silly it is.
Plays it deadly serious.
All straight-faced and deadly serious. This AI is a big problem. And no one can realize it because they're all dumb. And the one person who does realize what's happening is too dumb to figure out how to explain it, even though the evidence is given by the very dumb robot on multiple occasions. The robot is actually doing things that will give him away, give it away. It will give itself away. And still, the guy who knows what's going on cannot come up with a shred of evidence, even though it's right in front of him.
I'm glad you led with that, because to me, that's the only takeaway is, sure, this movie's familiar as all hell, but the real problem is that it relies so much on every character being way too dumb to figure out the very obvious shit that's going on in the house, the very obvious shit the robot's doing, the very obvious shit that happened in the past. Everything is very obvious, and the characters find out it's like a revelation. It is astounding how many times this happens.
It is also astounding how many very specific things the movie sets up that you know are going to be used later, like deepfake technology. Deep fakes?
It says it right away.
It says it immediately. Like, that's a weird thing to just say right off the bat, especially in the context that it is, where it's like the CEO of the company that makes Tim. It's like, oh, that's not really me. That's deepfake technology. Like, couldn't you have sat down and recorded like a message for like 30 seconds? No, apparently it's deepfake technology because we need to have deepfake technology later in the movie. It's so many of those things.
My favorite dumb character moment is when the guy who is deathly or is like rightfully scared of a robot and like is worried about what he's doing and up to, when he gets into an AI powered car.
Yes. 5 minutes. That's hilarious, five minutes later. Because it sets up like, I'm not getting in that damn self-driving car operated by AI because this AI has got something out for me. And then is like 5 minutes later, like, you know what? I guess I'll get in that AI self-driving car, even though this robot's out to get me. Like,
it's stupid, man. It's so stupid. Dumb. The robot is jealous and trying to take the role of her husband because he can meet her needs better than her husband can. So like, because he connects with you, right? He like, you basically connect with Tim, like, you give him your passwords and you let him on your network. And he knows, the crazy thing is like, he changes his appearance because Georgina Campbell's character, he noted that she stared at pictures in like newspapers. If the men look like this, she stared this much, 2 seconds longer. So I made myself look like this.
I love the idea of Tim, the robot, the android, going out in a car for a day out of town to get his hair dyed.
Yeah.
Happens in the movie.
You don't like my appearance? I will change it. I mean, it's like a fine performance as a guy pretending to be a robot.
He's creepy and perverted and funny. And two of those things are supposed to be the case with the character. I don't think it's supposed to be funny.
I like when he starts like giving her stats about people who cheat and stuff because her husband's a cheater. He's like, well, he'll probably cheat on you again statistically. Like, he is just such a dickhead. He just really wants to be with the woman. And you know what? the idea of a human AI romance. I mean, I know we have a whole movie called Her about that, I guess. But like, it's such a compelling and thorny and interesting idea. But this movie is all about frustrating human characters doing too dumb, being too dumb to figure shit out. That it's just trying to be an AI cautionary tale. It's more a cautionary tale about don't be a dumb idiot human. Like, I don't know. Everyone is so fucking stupid.
Doesn't come up with a good excuse like Her or some other smarter movies about AI does of what the relationship is. It literally is, they sit down and watch an old movie together and he's like, oh, I think I love this person. The robot literally falls in love with her and becomes jealous. And that is actually what's going on. There's no logical explanation for it. It's just, what if this were to happen? This completely illogical thing that I can't tell if Georgina Campbell's character is too smart and realizes that this is a stupid idea and that it could never happen and it's not going to happen that way, or too dumb to not see it happening right in front of her, like getting undressed and Tim staring in the mirror at her.
Yeah.
And she notices. She notices it's...
Yeah, no, that's what's interesting about it is I feel like she's interested in it. Like, because her husband...
She has
problems with her husband. And, like, it's definitely implied that she's not disinterested in it. But, like, the movie does not go farther.
I don't think it gets... If it is going for that, it does not hit that note hard enough to realize it. Because I didn't even think of that as being the reality. Especially when it goes to the third act, where it becomes... I don't want to give away too much, but like characters will just suddenly appear out of nowhere to help save the day and then disappear and then resurrect for like 30 seconds to help save the day again. It's so goofy.
It's a shitty movie. No one will see it. It doesn't exist. 1.5 stars for Tim.
Yeah. 1.5 stars, mostly because of how much I laughed at it.
All right. And now we're in the foreign corner. After being in our, where were we before? Our indie corner, after our streaming corner. All right, here is The Settlers, which is Chile's submission for best foreign film at the Oscars. Here's a trailer.
El problema son los indios. Voy a tener que limpiar esta isla.
I know others like him. Half Indian, half white. You never know who they're gonna shoot.
Talk me through this one. What is The Settlers?
The Settlers is set in the early 20th century in Chile, in southern Chile, and it is about a rancher businessman, based on a real person, who has been given by the government free access to land, a path for his flock down to the Atlantic Ocean. So going down and around Tierra del Fuego, all that area. And it's basically a Western where it's three guys on an expedition. One of them is a British, he calls himself a British officer, but he's clearly Scottish. And that becomes a point.
Yes.
A Texan cowboy named Bill, who joins the expedition. And then a half indigenous, half Spanish man who's a ranch hand on his farm. And the three of them are going down, and it seems like the mission is pretty straightforward, where it's just charting a course. How do we get there?
Westward expansion. I don't know if it's westward.
Well, southward. Southeastward.
Southeastward expansion.
Southeastward, crossing various bodies of water to get to the islands, the archipelago. Anyway, that's the premise. But it turns out to really be about another historical crime of colonialism. And it is about the genocide of indigenous people in Chile and in Argentina and South America. And it is really intense because of how casual all the violence when it does erupt is.
Yeah.
These characters are just the two, the British officer and the the cowboy are just, they're just chilling because they just are like talking about this stuff like it's nothing. Like, this is just what we do. This is our job. This is what we do. We kill people because our boss ordered us to. And no second thoughts, no nothing. It's just the casual brutality of it. And then Segundo is the name of the character who's half indigenous, and he's kind of complicit in what's going on. He sees absolutely what's going on, and that's what's really horrifying about it. He sees what's going on. He could stop it. They set up the fact that he's an expert marksman with a rifle. He could easily put an end to at least this. But then the bigger question is, what good would that really do? Would stopping this particular slaughter of unarmed people in the fog, would that really do anything? Or would it just delay the inevitable? And that's when you really start to think, like, this is really getting at some really thorny ideas about not just the crimes of the actual murderers who carried out this stuff, but also of people like the line between complicity and just going along with things. Complicity is.
Well, once the movie uses the word optics at the end, and it's mm-hmm. That's what it's about. It's about, the aesthetics of genocide, like tone down the rhetoric about how proud you are of killing Indians. And the ending reminded me of Killers of the Flower Moon in a way,
mm-hmm.
because it's like ring the who gets to tell whose stories bell, because that's what this movie ends up being about. And that ending is so powerful, with where it ends and how it ends and what it's saying about, Vadim Rizov tweeted about it, and I'll just read this. When people say something more succinctly than I can, I just like to say it so I don't end up stealing what they say, you know? The settlers, which is politically both righteous and obvious, but formally supple and strongly crafted across the board, with a last act wisely advising rebuffing any outsiders who claim to want to, quote, tell your story when they're just doing whitewashing for optics. That's kind of what's going on there.
Yeah, it's not necessarily like who gets to tell whose story. It's like how those stories were told and why we have been told these stories in this way for so long, because of politics and optics and business and all these things, this horrible intersection of it, letting the perpetrators of mass crimes tell the history, not the victors, but the murderers tell the history. And that's what's chilling about that ending. There's no violence in the ending. The epilogue is just people sitting in rooms and talking and sitting outside and talking and trying to convince people of things. And it is just so chilling to watch how easy all that is. The casual nature of it, just like with the slaughter, it's just another continuation of that attitude. It's a really strong film.
Yeah, it's really, really strong. I agree. I was kind of blown away by it, taken with it. I would love to see this be one of the five movies that the Oscars decide to nominate for Best International. But it does feel a little too brutal for that, maybe. But man, it is beautiful to look at. And like, just that cinematography is a big part of why it works. I think it's like that allure of the beauty of it, and they really capture it very well. Great movie. I think I'm 3.5 on The Settlers.
Oh, I'm a really strong 3 on it, but yeah, I'm no reason not to go up that extra
Half
for whatever reason.
It's all arbitrary. Yep. Very good movie. Seek out The Settlers. Driving Madeline is next.
Oh, mais qu'est-ce que vous avez à klaxonner comme ça?
Je suis prête. Avenue de Chavannes à Courbevoie.
Il faut traverser tout Paris, vous êtes au courant?
Si c'était à côté, je ne vous aurais pas appelé. Quel âge vous me donnez?
80.
Charmeur. J'ai 92 ans. Les médecins pensent que c'est mieux pour moi que je sois dans un établissement.
Oh, attends!
Ça vous ennuierait pas qu'on fasse un petit détour par Vincennes?
C'est pas notre chemin.
Oui, je sais. J'aimerais revoir mon ancien quartier.
Ok.
Le premier homme que j'embrassais.
Madeline needs to think about her entire life before she gets out of that taxi. Please describe this movie to me.
It is Madeline getting in a taxi and thinking about her entire life.
Yeah, what? I actually really nailed it.
Yeah, you did. I mean, that is it. But it's, oh man, it's just a lovely little movie about two people talking for no reason except just to get to know each other. And we don't get to see that in the movies. We do get to see movies about two people talking, like, especially in the indie scene, but they both like want something. There's some sort of underlying plot or metaphorical thing going on. This one, it's just two people talking that from different experiences, from different walks of life, and just learning from each other. And it's just such a sweet and lovely little movie with two really good performances. I can't underemphasize that these performances are so good. Danny Boone plays the cab driver who's like really angry, and he listens to this sweet old lady's story and figures out what's going on in his life. And Lynn Renaud, she's apparently a singer in France, like a big time singer. Like, I don't know what equivalent we would have here, but I can't think of it. She did some movies like in the 50s and then took off multiple decades just to do her singing career. And now she's come back in the last couple years to do movies. And this, she's really good here.
Yeah.
I don't know why she's not an actor, and I hope she has enough time to do some more roles because she's really good here. And that's not to sound bad. I'm just saying she is in her 90s, and yes, the character she's playing is in her 90s, but she's so compelling just talking about this woman's life. And there's a twist here. Did you have that same reaction when that one scene happens during the flashback with the husband? I'm like, "Oh, this took a turn."
Oh, yeah. It gets a little darker than I thought.
It gets darker. What I appreciate about it is that it doesn't go in the route you think it's going to go, where it's going to turn into like a mystery or something, or a thriller or something. Like, no, that's just part of her life. And
yeah,
it keeps
life
going.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Nice to see that. It's just nice to see two people talking with no like ulterior motives or some deeper allegorical idea going on. It's just,
yeah.
Like, don't you want to get to know these people?
Yes,
I kind of do.
It's an older woman imparting wisdom on a younger man who's still, you know, not young. He's probably like 40 something, 50.
Yeah, he's like 46, I think he says.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to hear. Yeah, 46, half her age, I remember. But yeah, he doesn't want to hear this stuff at first. But of course, you know, listening to her story and it, you know, Nazis killed her father and she had a child with an American soldier who she never saw again. And it's just like all compelling stuff. Her son was a war photographer that died in Vietnam, and just like learning a lot from her life, and this sweet relationship forms, and you realize that like he's never traveled, and he's really interesting line that he said. He's like, I drive this many miles every night, but like in circles in this area, and I've never really traveled. So yeah, it's just nice little movie where this guy kind of learns to be happy and maybe enjoy life a little more. And but you know what, Mark, I feel like it really snuck up on me, and I did cry at the end in a way that was such a schmaltzy, feel-good, crowd-pleaser way that it almost felt cheap to me the way it all happened. But I'm not going to like yell at this movie for like nailing exactly what it set out to do, because they like put the bait on the hook and I grabbed it. You know what I mean? So like they did what they set out to do, but like it's just such an easy cry at the end. They're like, hey, I bet we'll get you. And then they get you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but they only get you because they spend the time with the characters.
Yeah, I guess that's
like
true.
The characters. That's
but, like,
why it's affecting.
It's so head. Devastating. You're like, no, why didn't he go like early? Like, no, come on.
No, fuck.
Yeah, it's a bummer. But then like the final real crowd pleasery moment happens and it's like, what a nice movie. you just walk away going, you feel nice. So, like, yeah, I'm with
it
you.
It's just a nice, warm movie.
It's a nice, warm movie that I can't give below 3 stars.
Yeah,
I can't.
Three stars for me, too.
You simply can't do it.
It's delightful in its own little way.
All right. And now the final film of the week, another foreign film, Inshallah, a Boy.
كل شيء جديد حياتي انقلبت فوقاني تحتاني كله جديد وكل يوم في قصة جديدة
أختي صهرة قدم قضية عاجلة ضدك يطالب فيها بضم حضانة ابنتك من زوجك الراحل تحت ادعاء عدم الأهلية
هذا حقنا وهيك الأمور بتمشي
يعني لو الورثة مصاري كاش كان خدهم كلهم بس ما في غير هالبيت اللي عايش فيه أنا وبنتي
هو ما كنا توفى
Mark, this is one of those movies that I have to describe like uncut gems in that it's a stressful experience, but this one, much like Full Time, is about It's like a stressful, harrowing watch that's just about a woman trying to get through her daily fucking life. And this movie takes place in Jordan, and it's about a woman who is trying to get pregnant. Her husband doesn't seem super interested. Next thing she knows, her husband is dead, and her husband didn't like sign the deed or whatever to their house. So their house, the inheritance of the house, goes to his brother and not necessarily her, unless she were to have had a boy. If she had a son, the stuff would go to her automatically. Because she does not, it possibly could go to her brother. So basically, it's this woman. You're watching a woman constantly, you know, in America, I'm sure we've talked about movies where it's about a woman's struggle, and it looks very different, right, than this woman's struggle that has to deal with Sharia law and the fact that women, you know, can't drive at night, for one, and have no rights to things and stuff like that, and how everything keeps getting in her way, and how it's just a Herculean task to try and keep a roof over her head. And you're just watching this movie hoping that she doesn't lose her house because her husband's brother like would take it from her. And it's harrowing, it's hard to watch, but basically the plot ends up being, because of that little boy loophole that I mentioned, she pretends to be pregnant so that delays things and gives her more time, because if she has a boy, everything's fine. And what a potent metaphor for like the world that this movie takes place in, where the boy is like the key to unlocking everything and a woman's life is nothing. And it's about that. And it's hard to watch, and it's tough, but it's a good movie.
It's tough to watch. And this is one of the good things about January, is you get all of these movies that don't have all these foreign films that are going up for the Oscar for international feature that don't have some big independent studio. I know that's ironic, but you know, like a Neon or an A24,
a Jumbo
backing
Shrimp
up its campaign. Yeah. Yeah. They don't have that. These come out now, actually release in the theaters, not like for a week in New York, and you get it, and you probably have a better chance of seeing this than you do. I don't know, what's La Chimera is the big one, I think, from Neon that they're pushing for. You have a better chance of seeing this, and this one is worth seeing because, it reminds me. You brought up Full Time. You brought up Uncut Gems. I mean, it's obvious parallels are Asghar Farhadi's films.
100%.
Like a Hero, A Separation.
I wrote that down as well.
Yeah, it's that sort of, it's a very realistic situation based around society and culture and law and the specificity of that and how it makes everything so difficult for the lead character. And it is so, there's a lot of twists and turns here about what her plan is and her scheme, and it reveals so much about how women are perceived, even in a country in the Middle East that I think a lot of people see as a little bit more progressive than some other places. But this kind of tears back the veil on that, like, you can see certain countries in certain ways, but the foundation of law is still there for some reason. Like, this law has been around for like 1,000 years and it hasn't changed despite the country and the people within it progressing.
She's this just a mouse trapped in the apartment.
It's so, this film is funded by the Jordanian government to some degree. I was surprised to see that too, because it is so critical. And I'm wondering if it's, you know, what's going on there, because
there are so few Jordanian films. I was reading someone's on Letterboxd who attended a Q&A with the director, and there's like something like, I think there's under 100 period that like exist. Just crazy.
That's so, and maybe that says something too. Like, there's something going on in the past with everything, and then, you know, maybe things are becoming more modernized now. I don't know, but it's fascinating to watch because it is seeing how all of this society functions and what it can do to a single individual, and what the extent that individual has to go to just try to get what she's entitled to, her husband's inheritance, the thing that's going to let her and her daughter survive and have a home. It's harrowing in that way. And
that other character, like, she's like, she's watching like Aunt Colette or whatever. And then there's like another woman who I thought was her sister, but might not be. I think it's just
the
like
niece of the woman.
She's watching. Yep. Right. So like that woman, you know, is going through her own ordeal, and she's talking about how, you know, I'm, Why'd I get married? Because I wanted to have sex. And then once you are married, you are forced to have kids. Maybe some people don't want that, but because of the society they live in, if they want to experience sexual pleasure, they have to get married, and they get stuck in this trap. So it's exploring that. It's exploring what it would be like to get an abortion in this area and how that looks and how people would react to that. So it's like this multifaceted look at a woman's life in a repressed society like this. And it's a tough watch, but I think it's worthwhile. I wrote down the phrase, every sin has a motive and justification, which is like something that a character says in this and it rings true. I thought this was very good. It's a very solid 3-star movie.
Yep. 3 stars for me too. It's a good time of year for these little movies that will go over under everybody's radar, but here we are telling you about it.
A boy, God willing, a boy, if you don't know what that means. Very famous Arabic expression. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was 11 movies, if you can believe it. We did it in under 2 hours. A lot to recommend, a lot to watch. Go see The Beekeeper. Check out Settlers. You can skip most of those streamers, if not all of them, I think. I'm not going to recap what we just did. But please, go to Apple Podcasts. Keep the reviews coming in. Go to Spotify. Keep the reviews coming in. And we'll be back next week with hopefully less movies. Here's Alien Ant Farm.
The show starts in one...
Shut up. Ush.